And last controller of the borders with Iraq and Jordan up to this point, and it is now in the process of trying to redraw the strategic policies inside of Syria. Has the time for the Syrian Arab Army and its allies to directly confront the American occupation in the most important geopolitical and economic spot currently in the scene of the Syrian war?
Unfortunately, Syria cannot do that, not on its own anyhow. And the ally of Syria also are hesitant to have a direct conflict with the American troops in Syria. See, there is a lot of interest between Syria, Russia, and Iran to keep things calm, because Russia has its own problem with Ukraine. Iran has its own problem with the war of those oil tanks in the sea. And Syria has no resources to replace a single bullet they fire without going back to Iran and Russia. And Iran and Russia are ready and waiting for any conflict, military conflict, with the West. Therefore, they are trying to keep things through the political channels to get this thing solved without going to war. I do not expect a Syrian military to have direct contact with the American military present in Syria. Now, there could be some kind of resistance from the people of that region. Yeah, that happened a couple of times, and I think it happened with the support of the Syrian government and announced. And that's the only way we could keep doing it until we get those occupiers out of our land. No occupier will last forever.
Definitely. Well, Mr. Aqil Hanano from Atlanta, Georgia, I want to thank you very much, political commentator, researcher, and writer, for joining us to tell us what is really happening in the eastern part of the Euphrates in Syria. Hopefully, inshallah, not far from now, we will celebrate the full victory of the Syrian Arab Republic against all occupiers inside of Syria. Thank you very much, Mr. Hanano. Ladies and gents, thank you for being the best part of the Mideast Stream. I'll see you again next time on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Court proceedings in the election interference case against former President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants in Fulton County, Georgia, will be televised and live-streamed. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump's trial in Fulton County, Georgia, will be televised and live-streamed, a judge said on Thursday, 31st of August. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee said he will allow a YouTube stream of all related hearings and trials stemming from the investigation into the alleged scheme to overturn the state's 2020 presidential election results. The live stream will be operated by the court. There will also be pool coverage for television, radio and still photography allowed, the judge said. The former President Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty in the case. He surrendered last week at the Fulton County Jail after he and 18 others were indicted for allegedly participating in a criminal enterprise that aimed to overturn his loss in Georgia's 2020 presidential election. Donald Trump is charged with 13 felony counts. A date for his trial has not yet been set. This would be the first time cameras will be allowed to capture full proceedings in one of the four criminal cases brought against Donald Trump this year. Georgia allows cameras in the courtroom as long as they do not disrupt proceedings. A number of photographers were allowed inside the courtroom for a few minutes before the start of the hearing in Trump's arraignment in New York in April, before they had to leave the courtroom. Cameras are typically not allowed in New York courtrooms, but news organizations had asked for an exception. In New York, Donald Trump is charged with allegedly falsifying business records related to hush money payments to conceal damaging information before the 2016 presidential election. Cameras are also not permitted in federal courtrooms. Trump has been charged in two federal cases, one involving his handling of sensitive government documents after he left office, and the other relating to his alleged attempt to stop the transfer of power after the 2020 presidential election. Trump has pleaded not guilty in each of these cases and has claimed the prosecutions are politically motivated. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Court proceedings in the election interference case against former President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants in Fulton County, Georgia, will be televised and live-streamed, a judge ruled on Thursday, 31st of August. Judge Scott McAfee, the judge overseeing the case, said all hearings and trials will be broadcast on the Fulton County Court YouTube channel, according to multiple outlets. He also said pool coverage for broadcast news media will be allowed. Donald Trump and his co-defendants are charged in a sprawling racketeering case relating to efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in Georgia. The case could be the only one against Donald Trump the public is able to witness. He also faces two federal indictments, one relating to the mishandling of classified information, and another also relates to the 2020 election interference. But federal courtrooms generally do not allow cameras. The former president also faces charges in Manhattan relating to the hush money payments before the 2016 presidential election. However, if any of the defendants get their case transferred to federal courtrooms, as former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows is attempting to do, Judge McAfee's ruling would not apply in that case. Mark Meadows took the stand in Atlanta, Georgia, on Monday at a hearing where he argued his case should be moved. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones did not rule on the case at the hearing and will issue a ruling in writing at a later time, according to multiple reports. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. The Fulton County, Georgia judge overseeing the sprawling 2020 election interference racketeering case against former President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants says that all proceedings in his courtroom relating to the case will be live-streamed and allowed to be televised. The ruling, however, would be subject to change and would not apply to any portions of the case moved to federal courtrooms. In a court hearing on Thursday, 31st of August, Superior Court of Fulton County Judge Scott McAfee, who was assigned the case, said he would make all hearings and possible trials available to be broadcast on the Fulton County Court YouTube channel. Judge McAfee also said that he will allow broadcast news media to have pool cameras where groups of news organizations combine their resources and share camera access in the courtroom. Neither defense attorneys nor prosecutors appeared in court on Thursday, 31st of August, to oppose the news media's request for cameras. Thursday, Judge McAfee also ruled to allow members of the media to use cell phones and computer electronics in the courtroom for non-recording purposes such as note-taking. Judge McAfee's ruling is limited to the Fulton County state case. Multiple defendants in Georgia's sprawling state racketeering case, including former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, are asking for their cases to be moved to federal courtrooms, where there are no cameras allowed. Computers or smartphones are also not allowed in the court. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones could rule at any time on Mark Meadows' bid to move the Fulton County election subversion case to a federal courtroom, now that Meadows and the district attorney have filed dueling briefs weighing in on a follow-up legal question posed by the judge after Monday's hearing on the matter. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones had specifically asked the parties whether the case should be moved if the court found that at least one of the episodes described in the racketeering case pertained to conduct that Mark Meadows carried out under the color of his federal office. District Attorney Fannie Willis argued in her new brief that such a finding would not be sufficient for the case to be moved. Mark Meadows' attorney said it would be sufficient.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Blazing wildfire in Hawaii took the lives of more than 114 people. Finally, after days of dodging questions and stating no comment to inquiries about the tragedy, U.S. President Joe Biden visited the island and was met by angry protesters telling him to go home. The government has authorized to pay only $700 million despite massive damages. There are still many people missing and unaccounted for. The staggering number is said to be due to not sounding the emergency alarms or approve the release of water on time. Blazing Hawaii. Wildfires burned the island of Maui in Hawaii, displacing thousands of residents, destroying the city and killing more than 114 people. The unprecedented wildfire disaster was accelerated by hurricane winds, picking up momentum and causing people to jump into the ocean in an attempt to escape the blazing fire and fuming smoke. The historic town of Lahania was burned down to ashes.
Experts claim that the climate change has caused rising temperatures and droughts even in the Hawaiian island. During rainy season, some of the vegetations on the island grow tall and in the dry season can easily catch fire and spread the fire throughout the island very rapidly. The disaster in Hawaii is similar to the wildfires caused in Greece, Spain, Portugal, other parts of Europe, and of course, Canada.
It's hell on earth. Raging fires on the Hawaiian island paradise of Maui, a major destination for honeymooners. Scenes from the island are described as apocalyptic. The lieutenant governor says the hospitals are overburdened with burn patients.
My gallery likely is destroyed.
I spoke to antiques dealer Alan Dakar, who shot this extraordinary video of businesses going up in flames in the town of Lahaina.
There's a lot of people in the community that have it a lot worse.
Lahaina resident Mandy Ellen, who is visiting Las Vegas, spent a stressful night worrying about her family on Maui. They're fine, but her home was destroyed.
The fire started coming in from both directions, and it was either they have to leave or they would die.
The fires are being driven by 80-mile-an-hour gusts from Hurricane Dora south of the Hawaiian Islands. Victims jumped into the ocean to escape the flames and smoke.
Hawaiian Electric Company is allegedly responsible for the deadliest U.S. wildfires in the past 100 years. Maui County is now suing HECO, alleging that the fire was caused by the company's negligence. The disaster has caused an estimated $5.5 billion in damages in Lahania and Kula and taken more than 114 lives. Maui County claims that this catastrophe was preventable and the company did not do enough to prevent the disaster.
Yeah, so I think the reason why there's a little bit of a conspiracy theory going around this is because we're increasingly having people not trust the news media. I would believe that this is going to be the natural occurring events. You know, Hawaii is a volcanic place. If there was any kind of geothermal disruption, if there was any kind of lightning strikes, if there was anything like that, I'm sure that would be the cause of it. Natural disasters do occur. I just think in the age of social media, where and also in the age where we do know that governments are not always the most honest when they could be, of course there's skepticism. I don't think it's space lasers or anything like that. I'm sure there's a natural explanation for the fires in Maui.
HECO is a publicly traded company that provides 95% of Hawaii's electricity. Federal officials are still investigating the incident, but many electric poles had failed with high-speed winds, and videos on social media displayed how falling power lines were starting flames and fire. Maui County has accused the company of not maintaining the power grid and electrical system properly and not cutting off power to prevent the wildfire.
Well, I think the federal government itself was, Joe Biden was very slow, and his response to the people that suffered and lost everything was a $700 per family gift or donation, whatever you want to call it, but he's only giving $700 per family. The illegal aliens that are invading our country here in the United States get more money than that. Refugee resettlement folks get more money than that, like $2,200 a month. A month. This is a month, not a one-time deal.
Due to HECO's alleged role in the Maui deadly wildfires, the company's stock collapsed. The electric company faced another downgrade to its credit rating, and Wells Fargo said that the most likely path the company is headed towards is bankruptcy. The company's shares fell 20% to below $10 after Maui County sued the company for negligence for its inactivity in the disaster.
More than 2 weeks after the Maui wildfires, the missing remained nameless until late Thursday.
We're releasing this list of 388 names today because we know that it will help with the investigation.
Maui County officials hope publicizing the 388 identities will help narrow down search and rescue efforts.
We do know that once those names come out, it can and will cause pain for some folks that are affected by this. This is not an easy thing to do, but we want to make sure that we are doing everything we can possibly to make this investigation the most complete, thorough to date.
Meanwhile, the victims that have been identified now include a family that ranged in age from 73 to 7. The young boy, the first known child victim from the fires. There's anger on top of pain. Questions and lawsuits are taking aim at Hawaiian Electric. Maui County is alleging that the state's main utility showed negligence by failing to shut power off amid fierce winds and a fire weather watch. Cell phone videos from the early hours of the blaze show sparks flaring near toppled power lines. In a statement, Hawaiian Electric said they're, quote, very disappointed that Maui County chose this litigious path while the investigation is still unfolding. The lawsuit also claims the company has compromised evidence by removing damaged lines and other equipment, evidence of potential liability in a disaster whose toll remains incalculable.
There are more than 1,000 people unaccounted for after the wildfire, and a list of names have been released. Some of the missing have come forward or called in and announced that they are safe. According to grassroots activists, the island's resources and land have been extracted not benefiting ordinary residents, but for the interests of outsiders building lavish mansions, golf courses, resorts, draining water resources. But how did the federal and local governments respond to the disaster?
I think that this is one of the issues about Americans culturally is we do expect a certain amount of competence from our law enforcement and firefighters, but the truth is that you shouldn't rely on them in order to save you. As far as what I can see on social media, people have said that the first responders actually did a little bit of harm where they were blocking people from getting home in order to save loved ones, in order to save pets, in order to save family members. And as a result, there's a lot of grief and anger from the local response not being quick or organized enough. And as a result, maybe trapping or failing to evacuate some people who were in dangerous areas, and then also preventing people who were in safe areas but trying to get to the dangerous areas to save pets, families, and loved ones. They were unable to do so, and they were blocked from law enforcement. And, you know, it's a question about whether or not they would have been able to save their family members and pets. And that's tragic. And I think there is an okay amount of anger to have in reference to that. But I do think that when you're dealing with a dynamic situation like this, where the fire is constantly changing, the situation on the ground is constantly changing, law enforcement and fire department are doing their best to save life and property. Unfortunately, you have to triage your risks. And it's heartbreaking, but obviously there has been some loss of life as a result of the choices made by first responders.
Water theft has been going on for decades on the Hawaiian Islands. Many native Hawaiian communities living in Maui, Komohana are cut off from water for their basic needs, which include drinking water, laundry, and water for crop irrigation. The reason these people are cut off is that the streams that flow through the valley have been diverted towards luxury clubs, resorts, mansions, and other facilities used by the rich and tourists.
Well, the people, the working people, the military people, the poor people, not the rich, the rich people there that lives on Maui were not affected at all. You know, like Oprah Winfrey and these big mega movie stars, they were not affected, not one bit. It was the hardworking people and the locals and the natives of Lahaina that has lost everything, everything. And now they're at risk of losing their land because they make the local government may condemn it. They may take it from them. They're trying to pay them for it now. And I'm sure they're not paying them what it's worth, what it was worth before the fire. But, you know, the average person in Maui has been affected tremendously. They've lost everything in Lahaina.
When the fire broke out, many natives who were cut off from county water lines also naturally didn't have any fire hydrants or paved roads to escape the fire. Therefore, some of the natives had very little or no water to fight the wildfires, while the crucial water needed was instead filling up the water ponds or golf courses, swimming pools on resorts, or watering the massive lawns of mansions owned by rich American outsiders.
People are concerned because what's galling for me is I see in the midst of, you know, all of this attention and focus and resources being streamed towards Maui that really there's a naked power grab and really a land and water grab that's also underway. There's been talk already about folks getting offers on their homes, and I know from friends that that's happening. But as I mentioned, there's also water grab in the works, and the discussion around this really makes me fear for the future of Lahaina and whether or not it will be one that includes Native Hawaiians and other local people, or whether the build back will focus on outsiders.
U.S. President Joe Biden had also chosen to stay at one such mansion in Lake Tahoe instead of visiting the disaster-stricken region, and finally, after criticism and pressure from the public amassed and mounted, he finally cut his vacation short and flew to Maui for a tour of the damages the wildfire had inflicted on the country and also to speak to the victims and survivors of the disaster. How was Biden received on his tour of Maui?
So the reaction that I saw on social media was apparently he tried to sympathize with the victims by relaying a story in which he did not lose as much as them. I'm going to be a little bit mean here and say that, you know, President Biden, he can be sharp for about, you know, 20 minutes at a time. And then it seems like his mind wanders a little bit and he just kind of says what he wants to say. Some people have called his comments insensitive, considering he was pretending to know the damage. And, you know, we're, of course, talking to people who have lost their homes. They've lost their pets. They've lost family members. You know, there's a particularly tragic story of a 15-year-old losing his life. So it seemed like President Biden's story was not in keeping with the gravity of the situation. So he received some criticism on social media.
Upon arriving and speaking in Lahania, Hawaii, Joe Biden faced curses, protest chants, and signs that said no comment, since he had repeatedly avoided commenting on the disaster and tragedy that took the lives of at least 114 people in Hawaii. Locals chanted, "Go home, Joe," when the president's motorcade passed by. Some locals pointed out that the airport hosting the presidential helicopter hasn't been used much to deliver crucial supplies.
You know, I think that when a president of the United States takes a trip anywhere, especially within our own country, especially after a disaster, I think that there's going to be good photo ops. You know, there's going to be a lot of positive news coverage from the corporate media about the visit, about the response on that he received. But, you know, in reality, there are viral clips going around all over the places I kind of alluded to in an earlier answer about of Hawaiian residents, you know, Native Hawaiians, just folks who have moved on to the island in recent years, recent generations, of heckling Joe Biden, of flicking him the bird, you know, sticking their middle fingers up at him. So I think that that you're seeing a lot of the locals push back against his visit there. And it's not just Joe Biden. You know, it's not just some kind of anti-Biden response. It's the entire federal government, and many of the state and local officials are receiving similar pushback, because when push came to shove, just as has happened in other corners of the United States over and over and over again, governments failed the people. The government that is supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people failed the people. In many instances, they let this fire burn as wild as they could to inflict maximal damage. You know, before Joe Biden even touched down on the island, private investment firms, private equity firms like BlackRock swept in and started trying to buy up land, started doing all that they could to position themselves on this disaster-wrecked island so that they can be in a position to gobble up as much of it as they can. So before the federal government's even coming in, you're having private equity, really crooks, financial crooks, who are all in bed with the World Economic Forum, with many members of America's federal government and other national governments around the globe. And they're already sweeping in there and trying to gobble it all up.
Hawaiians and locals were outraged by the president's saying no comment when asked about the wildfire disaster on August 13 after relaxing on a Delaware beach. Joe Biden also mispronounced the name of one of the Hawaii senators during his speech. The White House authorized a $700 million relief grant per household to survivors, but critics called him stingy and stated that Biden had spent $113 billion on Ukraine instead of spending it at home.
It seems like even based off of a preliminary research, there's a struggle in this area where there's tall, dry grasslands that indigenous Hawaiians like to use to cultivate crops. Recently, there has been an effort by the central government to allow indigenous people, which maybe is the wrong term, to give indigenous people back their access to the water. But when this is used for irrigation, that can divert water that would normally be used for firefighting services. As a result, the area became drier. And since it became drier, at least the public response, the public criticism so far, is that local farmers need to do a better job of making sure that water resources are allocated for the public utility. This is a balancing act for the United States, where we have essentially colonized the Americas. So there's an attempt to respect the rights of indigenous people, but at the same time, if it's going to cause disasters like these, at what point do you intervene and say, in the name of the public good, we have to have more intelligent distribution of water? That actually seems to be a political fight that is brewing on the island now.
The United States president was also insensitive in comparing the devastating Hawaii fire to a small fire that broke out at his house in 2004. He said he can relate because there was a small fire in his kitchen in 2004 and it almost cost him his cat and Corvette. He said, "I don't want to compare difficulties, but we have a little sense, Jill and I, what it is like to lose a home." He has referred to losing a home when the incident was contained in 20 minutes and the damages were only in the kitchen.
"I don't want to compare difficulties, but we have a little sense, Jill and I, what it's like to lose a home. Years ago, now 15 years ago, I was in Washington doing Meet the Press. It was a sunny Sunday, and lightning struck at home on a little lake. It's outside of our home, not a lake, a big pond, and hit a wire and came up underneath our home into the heating ducts, the air conditioning duct. To make a long story short, I almost lost my wife, my 67 Corvette, and my cat. But all kidding aside, I watched the firefighters."
Republicans have turned their criticism on Joe Biden. Donald Trump criticized Biden for saying too little during the first days after the catastrophe. The White House responded by stating that the president was in touch with the governor and emergency officials throughout the disaster. Joe Biden went on a short tour and visited some of the disaster-stricken areas of Maui with his wife, but immediately went back to his vacation in Lake Tahoe. What is the role of capitalism and greed in these disasters?
"You know, it plays a huge role because time and time again, we have big banks, we have private equity firms, we have vultures swooping into disaster areas to buy up all that they can at bottom dollar from people who have suddenly in an instant been turned desperate, who have in an instant had their lives turned upside down, who need all the help that they can get, who are in a vulnerable position. You have these vultures from big banks, from private equity firms, from big global corporate entities coming in and trying to gobble up as much as they can. So I think that it plays a major role in the aftermath of these fires, and I think and in any disaster. And I think that we're seeing it play a role perhaps during these disasters, as maximal damage appears to be being inflicted when it's really really avoidable. So I think that there's a lot of crossover there, but 110%, you know, they're really crony capitalists. I wouldn't call them capitalists. They're crony capitalists. They're fascists because they're in bed with the federal government. These are public-private partnerships, the merger of corporation and state, the merger of bank and state. You know, these are public-private entities that are coming in, taking advantage of people, gobbling things up. And all too often, it seems that the response or the lack thereof is being coordinated around giving these folks, giving these entities, these groups, the best chance that they have of coming in and gobbling up all that they can. So I think that it plays.
Brian Skatz, the Democratic senator of Hawaii, has said that as of late August, 85% of the areas affected by the fire had been searched and close to 2,000 people remain without power. 10,000 people are without telecom connectivity, and water is not safe to drink in certain parts of Maui, which makes it extremely difficult for the residents.
But what I saw was it was as though a bombing run had happened on Lahaina. It's flattened. It is razed to the ground. The sugar mill is intact. The lighthouse is intact. The banyan tree is still standing, but it's unclear whether it or not it will survive. But basically everything else is gone. We've got thousands of people now in temporary shelters. We're trying to restore power and telecommunications, but this is every bit as bad as the pictures. We walked down Front Street.
The Hawaiian senator said that although immediate aid such as water, food, and blankets have been distributed to residents, the fire has burnt many people's IDs, phones, and other documents, so it has become challenging for victims to enroll in longer-term aid programs. Victims will need such documents to start the application process and receive much-needed aid. How has the wildfires affected Native Hawaiians?
My understanding, I haven't been to Hawaii, but I'm a former military service member and I have friends who have been to Hawaii, is that there is a distrust from local Hawaiians of the Americans because of the history of colonialism. And as a result, Native Hawaiians are disproportionately affected by poverty. They're disproportionately affected by lack of infrastructure resources. They're disproportionately affected by lack of access to first responders. So as a result, if they are poor, if they have less access to first responders, if they have less access to the richer areas, then of course they're going to be the ones who are most affected. Also, when it comes to the economy, if people are less likely to visit Hawaii, then you're talking about those dollars impacting that economy and as a result, increased poverty. So it's kind of a negative feedback loop.
Now, with more than 114 people confirmed dead and with many remain missing, there is no sign that the U.S. government or the rich elites of the country would reverse their policies. Greed runs so strong among officials and the rich that even at the times of these devastations, instead of trying to help the victims, companies are trying to take advantage of the people's desperation and take away their ancestral lands with very little compensation and build more lavish resorts that would bring about more disasters in the future.
Diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. A new opinion poll has suggested nearly half of Canadians are living paycheck to paycheck as the cost of living crisis continues to squeeze households in Canada. And younger people are more likely to say their finances are in a poor shape. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CTV News has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new report from TransUnion, with the cost of living consistently on the rise, more Canadians are continually turning to credit, with the average credit card balance now standing at $4,000. Data that came from the TransUnion's second quarter 2023 Credit Industry Insights report shows a 4.2% increase, or $94.8 billion in Canadian household debt compared to the previous year, with a total debt of $2.34 trillion for Canadians. According to the report, this growth was primarily fueled by mortgage loan debt, which has maintained a consistent pace of growth for the fifth consecutive quarter at a 9% year-over-year increase as existing home sales rebounded. To assess Canadians' financial management and debt handling, TransUnion examined demand, supply, consumer behavior, and performance for its credit industry indicator metric. In the second quarter of 2023, this analysis resulted in Canada achieving a credit industry indicator score of 106, marking a 1.6-point increase compared to the same period in 2022. However, the current credit industry indicator levels are in line with pre-pandemic levels, with a slight year-over-year increase driven by increased credit demand. According to the report, increased debt levels and rising interest rates have led to increased minimum payments, placing additional strain on already financially stressed consumers. The report also highlights that while Canadian credit consumers have historically shown resilience, there are now signs of some individuals, such as Generation Z, who are in their early careers struggling in the higher interest rate environment. Matthew Fabian, Director of Financial Services Research and Consulting at TransUnion in Canada, said in a press release, "Canadians, like the economy, remain persistently resilient. However, the combined pressure of a high cost of living and elevated interest rates has created a payment shock, as the cost of debt has grown even heavier for some Canadian households. While some financial pressure has been offset through savings and employment, many Canadian consumers have accessed credit as a means to short-term liquidity." Data shows that the number of Canadians with credit card debt went up by 3.3% in the first quarter of 2023, and consumers in all risk categories are accumulating more debt, with the riskiest group, subprime consumers who have lower credit scores, seeing an 8.9% year-over-year increase in their debt levels. According to the report, there has been a 9% increase in average consumer balances across credit products, surpassing $4,000. This is mainly due to higher spending habits, with the average consumer spending $2,100 on their cards in the second quarter of 2023, a 1.5% increase from the previous year. Even consumers with lower credit scores have upped their spending to $1,300, up by 4% year-over-year. However, as spending rose, the amount consumers paid towards their card balances each month decreased by 2.8% year-over-year. The data also shows that the demand for new credit cards continues to rise, with a 17% increase in the second quarter of 2023 compared to the previous year. Specifically, demand for prime and below consumers increased by 15%, while better-than-prime consumers saw a 12% growth in credit demand. When it comes to lenders, the report shows that they responded by experiencing a 12% year-over-year growth in origination volumes. This signifies an increased risk appetite among lenders, with below prime originations growing by 16% and prime and better originations increasing by 6%. Matthew Fabian explained, "This additional minimum payment has stressed some Canadian household finances, forcing consumers to make trade-offs in terms of how much they can allocate to cover additional debt. Matthew Fabian added, the sudden and often unexpected rise in minimum payment is referred to as payment shock and can have dramatic consequences as some consumers are forced to decide how to allocate discretionary income and in some cases, which bills or debt to pay. The Global News has also covered this story and tells us more. A new opinion poll suggested nearly half of Canadians are living paycheck to paycheck as the cost of living crisis continues to squeeze household budgets, and young people are more likely to say their finances are in a poor shape. The survey also suggests the Conservatives, who are hammering home a message about affordability, are gaining popularity, with 38% of respondents saying they'd vote for the Tories if an election were held today. And support for the Liberals, who focused their recent cabinet retreat on the housing crisis, is slipping. The opinion poll by Legger shows that 47% of respondents say they're living paycheck to paycheck, including 53% of those aged between 18 and 35, and 57% of people between the ages of 35 and 54.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
In late August, BRICS leaders met for their annual summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. Perhaps the most significant moment of the summit came when Iran was introduced as a new member, a country that has been under the heaviest of sanctions in recent years, and a country the West claims to have been isolated both politically and economically. But why did Iran apply for BRICS? Why did BRICS agree to admit it? How can the economic bloc and Iran benefit from each other? And what messages has Tehran sent to its sworn enemies?
Whereas the West has been trying to downplay the role of BRICS in international arena, the facts on the ground are indicative of an emerging world order with a paradigm shift towards the global south. In addition to Iran, five other countries, such as Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates will officially join the group in January 2024. Meanwhile, 23 other countries have also applied for the membership. But why do these countries want to join the BRICS?
The acronym BRICS includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The bloc was founded as an informal club in 2009 to provide a platform for its members to challenge a world order dominated by Washington and its Western allies. Apart from geopolitics, BRICS' major focus is on economic cooperation and multilateral trade and development. The BRICS founding members hold several records. Russia, China, Brazil, and India are among the top seven biggest countries in the world. Three out of five largest armies belong to BRICS. China and India are two BRICS countries, each with a population of more than 1 billion. BRICS accounts for more than 40% of the world population, a quarter of the global economy, and one-third of the surface of the Earth. Among giants like China, Russia, and India, South Africa seems to be like a dwarf. But the fact is, the country is the second biggest economy in Africa and the sixth biggest country in terms of size and population in the continent. South Africa has also the third biggest army in Africa.
You know that all countries across the world are looking for political, economic, and military partners. Basically, it's impossible to solve your problems in the international arena without partners and allies.
This is Sayyid Mahmoud Reza Sajjadi, former Iranian ambassador to Moscow. Mr. Sajjadi said BRICS is in essence an alliance against U.S. unilateralism.
The BRICS nations, including Russia, China, India, Brazil, and South Africa, are among the most populated countries across the world with huge amounts of potential and capabilities. A decade ago or so, these countries decided to form a front against American unilateralism so as to clear hurdles on their way towards economic progress.
Mr. Sajjadi believes BRICS should be happy to have Iran in its camp as the country can increase the group's military prowess.
In what ways is Iran joining the BRICS significant and important?
Today, Iran is considered as a nation that has long stood up against the Western hegemony. It's regarded as the leader of the resistance movement. So I think that BRICS is happy to have the Islamic Republic on its side. I would like to say something here. A few days before Iran attacked Ain al-Assad, former US President Trump had warned that if the Iranians do something against the Americans, he would attack 51 areas of Iran. Iran attacked, but Trump did nothing in retaliation. This means we are not afraid of American threats at all. This military power has just joined the BRICS nations. In addition, Iran has a great population and economic potential. I think it's a good omen that Iran has joined BRICS.
With the recent expansions, BRICS, or BRICS Plus as some may call it, now accounts for almost 46% of the global population. Adding high population growth countries like Ethiopia means BRICS could soon represent over half the world's population. The global share of BRICS GDP will be 29%, while with the addition of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Iran, its oil production will make up for 43% of the world production. BRICS member states are among the biggest producers of goods and among the major exporters of raw materials. BRICS is also important in terms of having huge, different natural resources, including rare earth elements. For example, Argentina, a new member, is a major producer of lithium, a critical metal for the clean energy transition. Moreover, BRICS members are home to cheap labor, crucial for producing competitive commodities. This is Kambiz Mirkarimi, Vice Chairman of Iran-Russia Joint Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Mirkarimi told us BRICS will give the Islamic Republic an extra bargaining chip in the international arena.
Do you think that joining the BRICS would decrease or perhaps eliminate the impact of sanctions for Iran?
There is no doubt that the more economic alliances Iran joins, the more bargaining chips the country will have in the face of those who impose sanctions. Without economic leverage, you cannot gain much in negotiations with your enemies. Even when you are involved in negotiations with private sectors, there are times your talks come to a standstill. But with more power and presence in the world market, you can go ahead with fewer interruptions.
At the core of the BRICS lies a serious intention to alter the post-World War II order in favor of a multipolar world. Washington's addiction with financial sanctions and its warmongers and scant, if any, respect for the billions of lives in the global south are only some of the reasons for the growing disenchantment with the prevailing international system.
The former Iranian ambassador to Moscow believes that sanctions are no longer a cause for much concern.
Man,
Look, I see the matter this way. Today, we are no longer affected by sanctions, and with our own capabilities, we can sidestep sanctions. Now we have to figure out how we can help our 25 countries that are under sanctions. Today, things have changed for us. We are no longer afraid if we don't accede to FATF demands, if US sanctions are not going to be lifted. Once they told us that we would have to import water from abroad, but you know things have changed, and all these threats are now threadbare.
The Islamic Republic's entry to BRICS was a clear message from Tehran that the so-called crippling sanctions and maximum pressure have failed to isolate the Iranian nation. The main BRICS nations, that is Russia and China, which like Iran are under a slew of sanctions imposed by the U.S. camp, admitted Iran among the first new members, a success story which debunks the myth of Iran's isolation. BRICS leaders recently supported Iran's right to its peaceful nuclear program, hoping for a final agreement between Iran and the P5 plus one group.
There are several certain positive perspectives through BRICS, and the first one I think basically relates to the fact that the world is experiencing an emergence of a new world order, and Iran is supposed to be compatible with this new world order.
This is Tohid Asadi of the Muqavemati Economy Think Tank. Muqavemati is a Farsi word for resistance, a word with high frequency, especially after the U.S. sanctions on Iran intensified over the past decade. To Mr. Asadi, the unsuccessful experience of the JCPOA, or the Iran nuclear deal, prompted the Raisi administration to look for economic solutions in non-Western alliances.
The truth of the matter is that getting into such alliances, such actually associations as BRICS, would certainly open up new fronts for the Iranian economy, which has been suffered from so many sanctions imposed on the country by Western and in particular the American economic system. And then the second point is that Iran is currently speaking, after President Raisi came to the office, opened a new front in its foreign policy agenda. Considering the fact that they spent more than a decade on talks with West, and the result of which was JCPOA signed and sealed back in 2015 as a UN Security Council resolution. But the result is that regardless of all these attempts by Iran, we received almost nothing in return, regardless of our full commitment to the deal. So it's provided a certain foreign policy perspective among not only Iranian political elites, but also among the public that this trajectory of putting trust with the West and talks with countries like the United States is not something that could serve the benefits of the country.
By supporting countries which have been under unfair sanctions imposed by the United States and its ilk, BRICS is in fact trying to make these economic pressures ineffectual. And this has unnerved the West.
Do you think that the U.S. is dissatisfied with the fact that Iran is going to join the BRICS Association?
I'm strongly convinced that emergence of such blocs and expansion of BRICS, Iran's entrance to BRICS, these are all indicative of the fact that the world is changing and the United States is not happy about this change, because it's just going to diminish the American hegemony over global economy, global politics, local politics even in some extent. And there are so many other instances clearly indicating this fact.
Following the annexation of Crimea by the Russian Federation in 2014, Moscow's trade interactions with the Group of Seven went down by 36%. That's while Russia's trade with the BRICS nations had 121% growth, without which the Russians would have experienced hard times. The Russia case has caused a great number of countries to consider BRICS as a way out of the West's clout. This has prompted even countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to join the group, despite their seemingly close ties with the West. That said, political advantages are not the only perks of the BRICS membership.